girl. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got a year. Oh, I feel nice.
This is Pam Wiley, and we're back on Community Voices with J.W., John Wells. And we have with us R.J. Smith. And R.J. is the author of The One, The Life and Times of James Brown. Now, R.J. has been a senior editor at Los Angeles Magazine. He's written for The Village Voice. He's been a staff writer for Spin, and he's written for GQ, The New York Times Magazine, Men's Vogue. And R.J., your first book, The Great Black Way, L.A. in the 1940s and the Lost African-American Renaissance, was not only a Los Angeles Times bestseller, but it was also the recipient of a California Book Award. So now you've tackled James Brown. I feel good. Da, 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 da. Okay, so why James Brown?
Why James Brown? That's the big question, yes. Well, I can't think of anybody. You know, we think about Brown being this, and he was an amazing musician and a singer and a dancer, and that's huge, and that's what I connected with first, but he had so many interesting things to say about the political world and as a social activist and someone who cared about African-American business and as an entrepreneur and a record company person. So many aspects of his life that most pop musicians don't get to, that all interested me about James Brown.
Amazing. Well, he, according to your book, he grew up in kind of grinding poverty outside of Augusta, Georgia.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. And his dad was a turpentine man.
He was. He worked in the trees in the forest, tapped the trees to get the turpentine out of them, and they sold it to make shellac and stuff.
And
Brown grew up in a shack in the Piney Woods area of South Carolina, you know, on the west part of the state, and it was grinding poverty.
And no mom.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing. Brown often said that, but as I wrote the book and did some research, I kind of realized that his mom was around and left at some point because the dad was a pretty violent guy. And I think Brown never forgave her, and so he kind of wrote her out of his story in a way.
Wow.
Was he closer to his aunt?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think of all the family members he was close to, that father, who was often there and brought him to Augusta from the woods area, was probably the one he was closest to. He called him Pops.
I thought Pops said the most amazing thing, and they moved to Augusta in the late 30s, you quote him as saying, some white folks run away from America. They ashamed. Black folks, they run all over up north everywhere trying to get into America.
You know, he was talking then in about the 60s and the early 70s, I think, when maybe the hippies and young white people were kind of looking for themselves out away from the cities. And yeah, at the time, you know, Pops looked at that and said, no, this is where we want to be. We want to make it success, and we want to take over. Not take over, literally, but we want a part of the pie.
Is that why he stayed in Augusta? Because I would think if I were black in the South, I would just get out of there as fast as I could.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, and Augusta was definitely a part of the South that you're thinking of. No question about it. It was a two-tier society, for sure. You know, Brown felt comfortable there. It was what he knew. He lived in New York for a while in the 60s and just felt more at home in the South. And I think also there was an element of he was a prideful, tough guy, and he liked the fact that he rubbed some people wrong in Augusta and said, oh, you don't like me moving in under your block? Well, how do you like me now?
Right, exactly. And he's had interesting relationships. Tell us about his relationship with Al Sharpton and Strom Thurmond.
Yeah, wow. And, of course, what's come out in recent years is that Al Sharpton, who had one of those scientific genome tests done, found out that he has distant relatives with Strom Thurmond. Of course, Al Sharpton, coming from the political left, a very activist individual, and Strom Thurmond, an arch-segregationist white guy from the South, couldn't be farther apart in a lot of other ways.
Except Strom Thurmond had an illegitimate black daughter, too.
That's right. And what that speaks to me is that what Brown liked about Thurmond, and I think they related as people, I think Brown felt he understood Thurmond in a way and vice versa, as Southerners. And I think that Brown knew or felt that Thurmond knew African Americans in a way that maybe white guys in the North didn't always.
And just couldn't fess up to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think so, too.
Now, Al Sharpton was a friend of Teddy Brown's, who was James's son, who died in a car accident in 73. And those two became, Al Sharpton and James Brown, after Teddy's death, became very close, almost a father figure to Al.
That's right. That's right. And Sharpton has been great, and he was very helpful to me. And he really carries the torch for James Brown. He really, of course, Brown said to him famously, I will make you a star, basically. And he also said, but you got to promise me you will do your hair the way I do it, and you'll never change it as long as I live.
That's right. That's right. So, and Al Sharpton has certainly stayed true to that promise.
Yeah, yeah. Now he sees himself as kind of a living embodiment of some things he learned from James Brown.
Or perhaps the hair apparent. Sorry about that.
But James was meticulous about his dress and about his hair. I mean, he'd have his hair professionally done in the morning when he woke up. He'd have it done before a show, and before he'd go to bed, he'd have it done.
He did three times a day. He always felt when he got up in the morning, he wanted to go out into the world presenting a face that people wanted to pay money to see.
Very good.
And, of course, that mugshot was not a pretty picture when he went to jail. That must have been very upsetting to him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot about that incident in 2004 when the mugshot came out that was not pleasant for people involved. And, yeah, I mean, to see him looking distraught and messy and exhausted, that wasn't the James Brown that any of us had seen before.
Okay,
and it was a revelation and a shock.
Tell us about that incident.
Well, you know, he was smoking a lot of PCP, a very, a ravaging kind of drug that lays waste to people half his age, and he was, you know, in his 60s then. So he's using this hallucinogen, and he had a history of using violence against women. He used his fists, and I believe that was when his wife, Tommy Ray, was feeling threatened and called the police on him. Of course, a week after that, they were performing together again in New York. So they had a real roller coaster of a ride of a relationship, but he was a violent person.
And do you think, especially the violence towards women, do you think that came from living in a bordello, his aunt's bordello, or do you think it came from his controlling personality because he was really a control freak?
Or his dad being violent?
Yeah, well, those are all good answers. Yeah, I think the bordello clearly warped his sense of women for the rest of his life. And I think that his father being a violent person and his mom not being around, that had an effect on him too. And as well, yeah, he was someone, this doesn't justify it, but perhaps it goes some length to explaining some of it, as someone who felt no control over his life as a kid, who didn't know where his next meal was always going to come from. When he got older, he wanted to control everything to make sure that everything that he didn't get, he could now get.
Absolutely.
And he was a control freak.
I have to say, listening to his song, It's a Man's World, always leaves me with very mixed feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a powerful song. But you know what's interesting to me? You listen to the end of it in particular, and he's screaming, he's lost in the wilderness, he's lost in the loneliness, something like that. It's, for all its macho demeanor, there's a way in which it's a really vulnerable song saying, I'm lost. I am a lost. Guys are lost.
This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, not one little thing without
a woman or a girl. He's lost in the wilderness. He's lost and bitterness.
He's lost. Yeah. And back to his controlling nature for his act and for his musicians and for everybody that was associated with the production. He was very controlling, but at the same time, he delivered one heck of a product. And I remember watching him a couple of times, but specifically, I took a look recently at the YouTube video of the 1964 Tammy show, and yeah. That is unbelievable show business.
It's great theater. You are right. I mean, he does the cape act and that amazing clip on the Tammy show. And you know what's fascinating to me is how someone who is so demanding and exacting on the musicians in his band, controlling about every aspect of the process of making music and a show, at the end result, it's so liberating. There's such an amazing feeling of freedom and openness that comes out of that clip and the music.
He certainly had the work ethic, didn't he?
Oh, you bet. He was the hardest working man in show business. He really thought it could all go away if he didn't keep performing every night.
Yeah. RJ, I'm from Boston, and I was in high school in April in 1968 when Martin Luther King was slain. And I clearly remember watching James Brown Boston Garden concert on GBH, which was the local NPR channel. And that,
right.
Of course, was facilitated by Kevin White. And, Boston, you know, people think of Boston as being a, you know, pretty cool town. It was a very racist town in 1968. And people still credit James Brown with saving that city.
Well, that's really a fascinating chapter. You know, as you say, there was people all over the country were angry and upset and feeling hurt.
Heartbroken. I was in Poughkeepsie, New York.
Yeah. And so there was fear. There was a fear of urban unrest at that moment. And, you know, Brown had this show that had been booked for Boston. And suddenly Kevin White saying, you can't do your show because it will bring people downtown. We want people to stay at home. And then somebody said, well, yeah, but if you bring people downtown and then you tell them, you know, that the show is canceled, then they're going to be really upset now. And so, yeah, they did this free broadcast show that no one knew what was going to happen. Would it work? Would there be what if there was something horrible that happened on stage, or what if there was violence on camera? What would that do? Brown was a real peacemaker that night.
He was, and he calmed the crowd. The crowd rushed the stage at some point, and the police wanted to intervene, and he was able to convince them to get out of the way, and that he personally calmed that crowd down. He appealed to the people watching at home, and everybody was watching that concert. Everybody.
Yeah.
And he appealed for them to be cool, and that this was in the honor of Martin Luther King. And I tell you what, that city would have burned.
Mm.
Oh, well, we don't know what would have happened, but certainly,
right.
if you look at the other cities around the country, it was a tough couple of weeks.
That's right. That's right. You are so right.
So maybe he went back to Augusta to just kind of change things there, because what the white people in the South needed to see was a successful black person.
Well, I think that he looked at it a little differently, and he looked at it as he liked Dr. King, and he believed in some of the things King believed in, but he also had this whole other, his motivating civil rights engine for Brown was black business and black enterprise and uplifting the community from creating wealth for everyone. And he went back to Augusta, as you say, very much to build business. I mean, he wanted to live there and he liked it. But he also wanted to start businesses up there that would hire African Americans, that would, you know, employ and empower people that way.
That's pretty gutsy.
RJ, you spoke to so many people and did such a thorough job on this book, and it's a great read. The one person you did not speak to was James Brown. If you could speak to him, what would you ask him? What would you say? What do you want to know about him?
Wow. You know what I would have loved would be to have been a fly on the wall in the studio, watching him interact with the musicians and come up with some of these amazing records. I would love to just have been able to watch him work, and because, you know, here was somebody who was on one level a really amazing, instinctive genius of a musician, but he also couldn't read music. And he had some of the best musicians who went to music school and could write it. And so to see him together trying to flesh out this complicated groove, I would have loved to have heard that.
Now, let's get that leads right into why you call this book The One. What is The One?
Well, The One to Brown was a few things. And he always would talk about it as being the secret to his success, his special philosophy. On one level, it's a music term. He wanted to emphasize that the first beat of the measure, come in strong, instead of like waiting for the second beat and the fourth beat, which a lot of pop music, which the blues and other musics do. He wanted to hit it from the beginning. But beyond that, you know, you'd interview him. I've read many times in interviews, you know, people ask him what the secret to the music or where does it come from. And he would always say it comes from the one. And it was a life philosophy of living in the moment and doing for yourself and not counting on anything that might happen tomorrow. You got to live in the space you got right now. And then people would ask him to really spell out and define the one, and he'd say, I can't tell you that. He wasn't going to give his secret away.
He might have been teasing. Is that possible?
Yeah. And the fascinating thing is you talk to some of the musicians, and their sense of what the one means is really different from what he said it meant. Or some of the musicians, frankly, kind of said, well, what I think the one means is, I know what it means, and he wasn't talking about that. Some people say that it didn't mean anything.
I think his musical director said that.
Yeah, right. So it had a lot of different definitions to it.
This is the kind of book that should appeal to people interested in making music, listening to music, because once you hear about the one and hitting that first beat instead of waiting for something else, then you're always aware of what he's doing when he's the I feel good. That doesn't wait for a second beat. It comes out right on the first beat.
He wanted to get you from the get-go. He wasn't going to wait around. He was afraid he was going to lose too many people, so he grabbed them from the start.
It reminds me of what Ted Turner said about himself and Jane Fonda, that they were two super achievers driven by galloping insecurities.
That's it. Galloping insecurity. That's a good definition of what motivated James Brown.
And did he work.
RJ, what's next for you? What are you working on?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'll be very honest. I don't know where I go after James Brown. I mean, James Brown is such a dominant figure in the last century, in my life, in lots of people's lives. And I would never say never to something else, but I haven't figured it out yet. I'm still in the shadow of James Brown.
Well, we hope you find something soon, because this is a great book. I love some of the things you've said in it. Just rhythm created community. It brought news. That was stellar the way you said that.
I wanted to jump in, but he had more than 40 Billboard hits, but he never had a number one on Billboard. Is that something that bothered James?
I'm sure he always was driven by the fact that he could have been bigger. He could have the accomplishments that he didn't have always were a reminder to him. So yeah, you know, I think. After Barack Obama was elected president, I bet James Brown seriously would have thought, at least in passing, that he should have been the first African American president. there was always something he wanted he wasn't a modest guy.
Maybe it was a great benefit that he never did get the number one, because it kept him driving, right?
Yeah. Well, that's true. I hadn't thought about it that way.
That's what a classic star, and you've written just this wonderful biography of him, And we didn't get into his James Brown was born dead and he fought his way into this world. And that was a great way of him seeing himself, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, if you want to hear more about that, pick up the one and it will be in there.
All right, good. Well, we've been talking to R.J. Smith, who has written The One, The Life and Music of James Brown. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, it's been a thrill to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
We wish you the best with this book.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, R.J.
Thank
All
you.
Right.
So good!